You're listening to Potluck, the podcast that stirs up a unique flavor of people, culture, and brands in Asia. Hosted, as always, by Scott and Drago.
Welcome to the latest episode of Potluck and our fourth guest interview of season two. This is Scott, and as ever, I'm joined by Big DD himself, Drago Djurov. Drago, the sun is shining, we've had our kopi, it's the end of the week, and somehow it's May already. How are you doing?
Good morning, Scott. All good. A bit over-copied, perhaps. Hope the mic won't pick up my palpitations. I haven't seen you for a few days since we went on that hike into the primary forests of Singapore. Vines and lizards and all. You were trialing your new hiking shoes, yeah? One thing you need to know about Scott, he likes to get his gear right. How did your feet feel after that hike, mate?
Yeah, very, very good, thanks, Drago. I must admit, I've been a bit of a victim of the whole COVID online shopping, self-gifting trend. Too many cookies following me around.
That's some next level stuff, mate. And speaking of next level, today joining us around the pot is Ajay, whose brand new title is Director Regional Partnerships Moonton Esports. Formerly of sports marketing agency Octagon, Zosport, a China-based sport talent agency, as well as integrated marketing agency Culture Group. Wow, sounds like the marketer's wet dream. We'll get to know a bit more about Ajay shortly. On his website, he likes to describe himself through three pillars, the holy trinity of his particular brand of marketing religion. He's the kind of guy who likes planning stuff, connecting stuff, and creating stuff. I think we'll hear more about each in a moment. All of your career, Ajay, so far has been in China. You've just made the move to Singapore to join the Moonton Esports team. Great to actually sit down with you and talk in the studio today. How are you feeling and what are your first impressions of your new hometown?
Guys, thanks for inviting me. It's been quite a crazy 4 days. In Singapore. I landed on Monday evening, and then Tuesday I received my negative result, and I've actually been exploring the city, so it's actually been a really pleasant introduction to your beautiful city. I'm excited, nervous. It's kind of that feeling before a race, right? But the good nerves. I'm really looking forward to the next adventure and journey, and thanks for having me.
Great. Thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks, Ajay. And to spice up the intro, we always start by asking our guests to project a little bit like we do in qualitative research on occasion, and think about themselves as a recipe, the recipe that defines who they are in some ways. So what would your main ingredients be?
That's a tough one. It's actually probably one of the toughest questions that we're probably going to go through today. And in answer to that question, I try to ask a few friends, but also, you know, trying to scale it down to some cuisines. And as you mentioned, that I've been in China and in the Orient specifically for around 11 years now. So I think it'll be apt to see what kind of Chinese cuisine I'm more attuned to, that represents myself. So I asked my wife and she says, you're definitely Cantonese cuisine. I'm not sure quite what Cantonese cuisine you're going to be, but the reason why I say that is because Cantonese food looks quite ordinary on face value, doesn't look particularly interesting. But when you eat it, it's actually quite an eclectic array of different flavors and it surprises you. So that's kind of like my first impression and my experience of you. And also that represents the place that's quite close to my heart. And I've spent quite a long time there. And obviously with Cantonese food and specifically dim sum, you can get your dessert first, you get the main course last, and you get the starters in the middle. So I think that kind of summarizes, I guess, my journey to date, but also I would say my personification of cuisine and food in myself.
Fantastic. So that's a bit of a dim sum mix going on there.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm looking forward to trying some dim sum in Singapore as well.
Great. Okay. So before we dive in, just a quick primer on the show format this season. With every guest, we break the discussion into three separate chunks. Part one sees us lifting the lid on Asia from the perspective of our guest. Part two looks at hacking humans, with the quickfire brand burns being our third and final part. Each segment is released as a standalone episode. But if you would like to hear everything in one go, there's always the Full Feast Edition.
Okay, so let's start by lifting the lid on Asia from your perspective, Ajay. You've been in the region for over a decade, as you said. You've spent a large chunk of that time in China. You've also been working around the region. Can you give us a flavor of your journey?
My journey was never planned. It's always been kind of off the cuff. And I would say 12 years ago is when I first came out to Asia. And that was when I was doing a summer internship at a Hong Kong-based hedge fund called HT Capital Management. And that was in 2008, actually. It's my first year of university. And I was working there for four months, and I was really exposed to, I guess, the pace of Asia, but also I was kind of intrigued by the different regions of where I was involved with, specifically in energy and consumer goods. And at that point, I thought, you know, let's really invest more time in a region and an emerging market that are going to be influencing our lives for the next 50 years. And 2 years later, I managed to have an exchange program in Singapore Management University, where, you know, 11 years on, here we are again today. And I thought that's really the time when I got to spend a lot more time in the region. And I thought, this is where I want to start my career. And this is where I wanted to, you know, have that platform to get new experiences. But at that time, quite frankly, I didn't really know that I was going to get into sports. So I was still going to go into investment banking, believe it or not. My background isn't in sports marketing or sports. I was going to start a job at Deutsche Bank as a graduate scheme in 2012. And before I started that job, I decided to buy a ticket to China before I was going to start that whole new journey. And I ended up in Beijing as part of that kind of 1 month journey and trip. And 3 days before I was going to fly out back to London to start my job, I decided, you know, this is where I want to start my career. And I didn't really have a job, didn't have a visa, didn't have any friends, didn't have any network, didn't know the language. But I called the recruitment manager at Deutsche Bank and I said, thank you, but no thanks. This is what I want to do. And they were just completely dumbfounded, like saying, mate, you've spent 8 months through this process. How could you do this? And it's like, you know, this is what I want to do. So the next day, I found myself in the Beijing Hutong, and I thought, what am I going to do? What do I do with my life now? And then how do I get a job, and what career do I want? And I've always been interested in sports from a participation level. I was going to play semi-professional cricket before university. I got offered a contract. Wow. I didn't necessarily have the time to go out and pursue that because of education and my family really wanted me to get a degree. But I've always been interested in terms of the commercial side of it. I never was going to be a professional athlete, but I thought, you know, getting involved in the business side of sports was really interesting for me. And at that time, I thought, you know, the best way is, like, let's just do a scour of the market. What are the biggest agencies and the biggest rights holders that have presence in Asia? And I started to do some research, desk research, starting to go out and knock on doors in specifically in Beijing, but also agencies that operate in Shanghai. And I managed to get my foot in the door with Octagon. And I guess I did a market study for them, and they luckily gave me an opportunity to start a role there. And that's really where it kicked off. And from then on, it's just been quite a steep learning curve, to be honest with you. It's never been, this is what you're going to be learning, and this is how you're going to do it. It's like, you have to learn how to do it yourself, and we'll provide you with a platform. And that's been the best way. So I guess in terms of answering the different roles I've encompassed through this period, I've always been on, I would say, the buy side of the sports industry. And that means you're advising brands on how they approach a different culture, a different category for sports, whether it's football or soccer, whether it's basketball, whether it's Olympic sports, and also different areas of sports and entertainment. So working with premium global rights holders like Disney or K-pop, for example. And then you're working with big global brands that are looking to enter this space and sell their products and services. And I did that for about 4 years at Octagon, and I really wanted to work with on more China business and more China focused opportunities, and specifically around athletes and young athletes, because that's also another topic which I'd love to talk to you guys about today. And I went to work for a company called Zoe Sports, and that's founded by the guys who actually founded the Nike business in the early 90s. Oh, wow. So those guys then set up their own consultancy managing athletes in China in tennis and basketball. And that's when I really got to work on the athlete side of the business and really understand you know, the athlete marketing side, and you're not just working with properties and events, you're actually working with human beings. And that was really, really fascinating. And then kind of like went back onto the brand consultancy with my last gig, and that's really where I stepped into the esports space, and I guess that this is where it's brought to me today into Singapore.
Fantastic. So we're going to come on to talk about esports in quite a lot of detail later on, Adji. But before we dive into that, we'd love to reflect on how you cut your teeth working on traditional sports in China, which we know spanned everything from basketball and soccer to the Winter Olympics.
In all honesty, I think it's the more you live in a place like China, the more you understand how much you don't know. The only thing I know about China before I came out to the region was reading a book by a guy called Jim O'Neill. So if you're not familiar with a guy called Jim O'Neill, he was the former chairman of Goldman Sachs. And he's the one that coined the term BRICS. And he wrote a book called The Growth Map. And in one chapter there, he obviously splits it up into Brazil, Russia, India, and China. And on the China chapter, he starts out with writing, you know, he went to on a trip with his wife to, I think it was Nanjing or Nanking, and he was on a boat, and he saw like kind of a faded ad. And it said, like, better English, better life. Mm-hmm. And it's like, he equated people at that time, apparently, if you have better English, it equates to better opportunities in your future. And mm-hmm. I thought, that's kind of fascinating. That's quite an interesting insight in terms of, like, people's attitudes towards education, but also different cultures. And I think another thing that inspired me about China, and also why continuously being a perpetual student of the culture, is when the impact of Beijing Olympics in 2008, because it was before that time, really the sports industry was built upon a Soviet model. Only 1% of the population were encouraged to actually participate in sport. So what Beijing did was open the country to the world, but also encourage people to actually play sports recreationally. So that specifically, at the time when I started my first gig in China, it was 4 years later, the industry is still quite small. So it's kind of, it was tough the first few years, because you're speaking to brands, you're speaking to executives at companies who don't necessarily haven't grown up with the culture of sport like you guys have and I have, but also the impact that it can be as a marketing tool, as a marketing solution. You've got obviously digital events, you've got special events, you've got PR, etc. And sports is like, oh, it's just sponsorship, we don't want our brand on this. So it was actually really tough to work in a global consultancy operating in kind of like an emerging market from an ads perspective, but also from a sports perspective. So that was really, really, really interesting and quite tough. But you really have the opportunity to work with big global blue chips that are looking to expand their business in an interesting market and a growth market. And I think those are the major challenges. I think just the infancy and the immaturity of the business, and that I think as we've grown, I've been in the region whilst there's been lots of different changes in the industry. So you've seen the emergence of cashless payments, you're seeing all these big companies that are looking to acquire intellectual property and become media companies in themselves, and that's happened in the space of 6 years. And you're seeing right now with Alibaba, you're seeing Wandar Group by Infront, you're seeing obviously these private investors investing more in esports as a cultural tool. So just to be in the nexus of that development has been really fascinating, but it hasn't been easy.
So what did you find most rewarding about that experience, Adrian? And a lead on from that is, can you bring it to life of some of the work you're most proud of from your time there?
One of the things I learned is how the country and the market really surprised me. And I think one of the key cases, if you like, that I can talk about is the Winter Olympics. So I was as part of the global team that was working to bring the Winter Olympics to Beijing. At the time, the country was competing with Almaty in Kazakhstan to be the host city.
That's in 2022 Olympics.
That's in 2022. That's going to happen probably just over a year now. So the country and the mayor of Beijing is now preparing to welcome international fans. So when you're working with the government, when you're working with a committee that's already gone through two Olympic bids, you realize just how commercially savvy these guys are. These guys are fully bilingual. They've worked with international media. They've worked with international stakeholders. So I think that's one of my key learnings. I think that's a really interesting misconception that I had, but it was completely proved wrong as soon as I started to spend 3 months in Beijing. I was working with the local governments and spending 2 months in Zhangjiakou, which they've then revamped into the center of winter sports in China. And then you're seeing the growth of Burton snowboards and all these different snowboard brands and North Face, Columbia. These brands are now growing with the industry as well. So I think those are I wouldn't say a proud moment, but it's been a really valuable moment just to say, you know, it put your misconceptions at the door as a foreigner, specifically as a Laowai or an Angmo, as you guys would say in Singapore, sure. And then really go in there with an open mind because you can learn so much.
That's really interesting. It's something you mentioned earlier and something that you seem to have subscribed to in your personal life as well. You know, you were talking about how it's important in strategy, you know, just as important, you know, to learn what to say no to as well as what to say yes to. And, you know, it sounds like you've said a lot of no's along your personal path, you know, saying no to Deutsche Bank, you know, saying no to that cricket contract you were talking about. Yeah. So, you know, you were a part of this really amazing experience in terms of sports marketing. But in recent years, you've kind of moved away from these, you know, quietly humming felt slipper mansions of sport marketing into kind of the Wild West kind of, you know, gunslinging, hectic space that is esports. What prompted the move? Was it more about saying yes or saying no in this case?
That's an awesome question. I think it wasn't really a thing that I had to think a lot about. I guess to give you context and your listeners context, the last time that I was in Beijing in the Bird's Nest Stadium before the League of Legends World Championships in 2017 was actually at a preseason match, a friendly between Arsenal Football Club and Man City. Oh. And I missed half of the game. So outside you can actually go to buy tickets for like $2, and some guys, like, you know, on the black market are trying to just flog tickets off. So when up going in there, and the stadium was a third full, and you're seeing Sergio Aguero, Douglas Costa, you're seeing Ashley Cole, all these amazing players in an empty stadium, and it's incredible. Like, you know, how can this happen? And then fast forward, I guess, 3 years later, and I was kind of the aha moment with me. It's like you go inside, you're on the track where Usain Bolt got that 9.5 second 100 meter record, and people are there to watch a video game. It's like they're watching a MOBA on a screen in the Olympic Stadium in Beijing. So I think that's really what made the aha moments, like, this is actually real. I mean, I've grown up playing FIFA, I bought a Game Boy, I bought the Atari, and then I've seen the trajectory of console gaming, and less so mobile gaming. So I think just from a personal perspective, I thought, you know, this is the future of sports and entertainment. And I think it's a rare moment in history that you can be involved in the birth of a sport. Mm-hmm. Typically, sports are country or regionally born. So like tennis was in the UK, basketball or NBA or baseball is born in North America, mm-hmm. and then it flourishes globally. But ultimately, esports immediately started being global. And that really was the start of it. You know, there's dragons flying over the bird's nest. Even before that, they had global competitions in China, mm-hmm. and in Asia and in Japan and in Korea that were taking place. And I think one of the things that really attracted to me to the space, you know, I want to be in there long term, is that it's a sport that is not born in traditional broadcast TV. Mm-hmm. So if you're looking at all these big deals and all these big valuations of these media sports properties, they really are, okay, someone's signed an NBA or an NFL contract for hundreds of millions of dollars, and it's all, a lot of it, well, that was valued on TV. But you're looking at a sport that is inherently a digital product. Mm. It's living on live streaming internet platforms. So I think that is something that doesn't necessarily happen a lot in the grand scheme of sports and in the industry. And I thought, so it doesn't happen, you don't happen to be in the right place at the right time. You know, Asia is driving the global esports industry, and specifically China is the biggest esports market. So I thought, you know, there's lots of things going for me, so I have to really invest more time in that. And I guess to your second point, yeah, you know, was it kind of like a push factor? Mm-hmm. I think what I feel is, I kind of alluded to this in my previous answer, just the price point of entry into these global properties like the EPL or the NBA, for example, to some extent, the World Cup is just cost prohibitive. Like, these are not small amounts of money that brands have to invest in. So I thought having a new, fresh approach on the industry and also in a new category and looking entrepreneurially at solutions, which is what the esports industry, I feel, needs, I can sort of marry my experience, my executive MBA, I like to say, the last 10 years, and with a new category, and like translate some of that experience to an industry which is really fresh and it needs that. And I think my last point is just shifting from the buy side, which is like, you know, advising brands on the sell side, helping rights holders work with partners, you know, how can this actually improve your business and shift your business is really, really exciting for me.
Fast forward, AJ, I know Drago's already touched on this, but you know, you've just started this new role with the Chinese games maker Moonton. They've been recently acquired by ByteDance, obviously, the TikTok owner. You're based out of Singapore. So first of all, you know, congrats on that really interesting move. We were curious though, when it comes to like esports, what opportunities does Singapore hold, and you know, what are you excited about this sort of next step?
Thanks for the congratulations. I really appreciate that. And I think Singapore specifically has so much going for it. I think Singapore, along with probably 2 to 3 other cities in the world, those being Shanghai and another one being probably Berlin, in the world, in Europe, if we're looking at geographies, is vying to be a global capital for esports. And this year, within a bubble, it's hosted 2 major tournaments, the M2 World Championships for Mobile Legends and also the Dota 2 Invitational. The prize money is not small. It's hundreds of thousands of dollars, which in this time of human history and sports history is actually quite a significant amount. And I think there's so many drivers coming from the market, which I think that really put the country in a great position. I think one of the things is just the multi-language and multilingual society we have here. And I think we were downstairs having a coffee before the recording, and you can have 3 to 4 different languages just of groups, people around you speaking, from Bahasa to English to Mandarin Chinese to Tamil or Hindi. And I think that's great, because if you're looking at a country like China, a lot of the streams, a lot of the professional content, the short form, long form vignettes in around the game itself, they're all in Mandarin Chinese. How is that going to resonate with someone who's watching the content in Europe? I just don't think it happens. And similar to with Europe, a lot of the feeds for these leagues are in English. So how is a fan of a specific title going to be engaging with that content or really appreciating that if they can't understand it, even if the quality of the competition is really high? And I think the fact that there's the GF, which is Global Esports Federation, is based in Singapore as well, I think that's also a great driver, because we'll chat a little bit about this later. I feel as though as it will become esports a medaled event in the Olympics, the fact that you have one of the federations based here in the country, I think that's only a good thing.
Ajay, we're conscious many listeners may only have a surface level awareness or understanding of esports. So before we delve deeper, what kind of primer can you give us around the sort of ecosystem and how your role actually fits into that?
Sure. And I think the first thing, and this is, I'll give you some anecdotes from my personal experience, like how do we get into esports? What partnerships can we do tomorrow? What are the best events to sponsor? I think before we even go into that conversation, I would advise, or just from my experience, like to take a step back and really delineate between general gaming and in esports. And I think games is something that we've been doing for so long. You can be playing Animal Crossing with your kids over the weekend, or you can, on your commute to work, you can be playing Street Fighter or FIFA on the phone. That's just general gaming. You know, we can be even playing Candy Crush or Tetris. You know, that's just a form of entertainment. Now, whereas esports, and this is just very simple definitions we're trying to carve out, esports is just the competitive element of gaming, which means as though you're combining the storytelling of esports and the entertainment aspect that with the competitiveness of traditional sports. And that's really what esports is. So they have athletes, you have teams that are competing in leagues, organized competitions for prize money. So I think when we're looking at how we're looking at that area of culture and also sports is that, I guess this is some advice that I've been given from my mentors and also actually a guy called Musa Ahmed, who if your listeners Google him, he's actually the very senior executive, CMO, I believe, of former CMO of Airbnb Experiences, and he's got a great course on business and fashion, where like, how do you strategize your life? And I think how do you strategize your esports offense? And I think if you're listening out there, I'll just get an A4 piece of paper, I'll put it landscape, and then draw six different rectangles from left to right, equidistant, and then within that you put developer from the left, you put leagues and events, you put teams, you put athletes, influencers or creators, and then the last one on the right, you put broadcast partners or streaming platforms. And ultimately, that is a very simple way of looking at the ecosystem. And they're very much intertwined. But ultimately, what you need to understand is that the games are owned, or the intellectual property is owned by the game developer and who published the game. So ultimately, it's about the game. And the real people that matter within this ecosystem are the fans themselves, which are choosing the game, they buy the game, and they also interact with it. So they're funding everything that goes into this. Also, you need to understand that you're never going to own the game if you're a brand. So if you're, let's say, a fast-moving consumer good, you say, okay, how do we get into Fortnite, for example? You have to understand that Fortnite is published and developed by a specific game developer called Epic Games. Epic Games, for example, then produce different tournaments and competitions, World Cup events around the world. These events are participated, or there's teams that participate in these events across the world, and they employ professional players who earn salaries. These players are also looking to create content outside of their field of competition when they're actually playing the games. They also are content creators themselves. So as opposed to, like, you're looking at LeBron James, who's one of the greatest athletes of all time, LeBron James is also an athlete publisher. He's actually a publishing platform. So he publishes content when he's not playing on the field of competition. So just look at Space Jam, which has been launched in a couple of months, right? He's actually a celebrity in himself. So these athletes themselves are becoming celebrities. And I guess we're looking at the second to last rectangle, if you've drawn that out, which is influencers. And these are gaming influencers, celebrities, which are creating content, which isn't necessarily around the competitive element of esports. It's the lifestyle element of that. And these are actually a lot of the individuals which are driving viewership, which is ultimately distributed on the last rectangle, which is the internet streaming platforms. You've got the Facebooks, YouTubes, Twitch, which is owned by Amazon. You've got Twitters, Instagram, and then you've got all these other local platforms such as Huya or Douyin, for example, Nemo TV, which are more coming from China. So I think what you need to understand is that all of these different stakeholders are involved, but ultimately each of these different stakeholders are a sponsorship asset. You can actually partner with them. So whenever you're looking, if you're listening out there, and if you're a brand, for example, each one of these different pillars is actually a sponsorship asset for your brand. And another piece of advice I was given, or an anecdote, was from a former client, and he said, like, you know, strategy without execution is just a piece of paper. And ultimately, a strategy is to tell you what not to do as opposed to what to do. So if you have that very simple map and you map that out, obviously you localize it to each market. For example, Singapore isn't necessarily similar to the Philippines. The Philippines isn't similar to India. You can quite quickly map out what the landscape is, and looking at opportunities relative to competitor involvement. So I think that's probably where Scott, I would recommend anyone looking at the space just to delineate and then map that out before you even go even spending any money.
Yeah, that's fascinating. It sounds to me like you're very comfortable inhabiting this space already. Yeah, but how do you get there? You know, for us as researchers, it's fascinating to learn, you know, how you go about, you know, learning about these different, the six boxes that you talked about, as well as, you know, going into the different markets, you know, what they have in common, how they're different. So how do you go about, you know, learning about gaming culture in China and beyond, as you said, and also the different stakeholders? Yeah. Can you give us maybe some examples of your approach?
Sure. I think I'll preface that question with that. I'm not a trained strategist. I don't come from a research background. I'm not a research professional. But what I have learned in my experience today is, like, just really surround yourself with experts in the subject matter, whether it's you're going to be developing a football strategy for a brand and who really wants to go into that space. You just surround yourself with local market experts, not necessarily a market expert in general football, but really within that market which you're operating in. And I think also, before you even get to that stage, I think if, let's say, we're isolating gaming culture and, you know, talking to the Gen Zs and all that stuff, you need to go out there and spend time with the kids. You need to go actually spend time and live the life of what they do on a day-to-day basis, what role it has in their life. And I think it's the consumer that directly finances esports by the games they choose and directly impacts the product that's built for them. And if it's a bad product, you're going to know that because you're going to have a Reddit shitstorm on the next day. And if you don't improve it, they're not going to come. But if you don't even speak to them about what they want, why they buy the game, what do they like, what they don't like, what could a brand do? And this is a question that we've asked in numerous focus groups. Like, if you're speaking to XYZ brand who are looking to invest in esports in your country, what advice would you give to them? Mm-hmm. This is like a one-on-one conversation you have with the CEO. You record that, you chop it, post-production, mm-hmm. you present that in your final business case meeting. And they're like, it's not just research and data points. Like, you've actually gone out there, you've gone to a province, you've gone into an internet cafe, you're speaking to a kid who's 10 years old who is ciphering off Wi-Fi from the local cafe two blocks down, who's playing your game and who's on your network, and this is what he thinks about your brand, this is what he would want or she would want if you're going to invest in that space. And then again, that's where it really is important to take down notes. I've probably got like 5 books which I've just written through, like jotted down jargon, generally speaking, but there's anecdotes within that which we've included in presentations, which form strategy, which form flow of frameworks, which how you help your clients achieve their goals. And I think the second point, Drago, which you mentioned, like, okay, what's my approach, is that it's such a new space, man. So I think within your team, let's say within an organization, you probably have people who already play games. Mm. You already have people who are playing Fortnite when they're not working, or who are playing PlayStation 5. They bought PlayStation 5, which has just dropped actually now in China, and they've just vaporized, and people are just buying like crazy. But who do this outside of their place of work. So if you are going to invest this in this space from a corporate perspective, involve those people, because again, they would know how the community speaks, they know what the faux pas are, they know what's hot, what's not. And then I think those people then become centers of excellence within the company. And I think that's why it's been a kind of an interesting experience of, you know, just talking with consumers. I think the qualitative research is still very, very important, and I don't think it gets a good rep. Obviously, quantitative data, when you're mapping out the size of the pie, like XYZ game has how many gamers in this market, how many months of active users, what data can you share from a rights holder to us as your potential partner around the behavior of that person, and how can we then cross-pollinate, is really important, don't get me wrong. But I think just talking to your team internally about, you know, educating different divisions, because it's not just one division. If you have one division, that's got to work with all the different divisions around a whole new space. I think those are just some hacks that I've come into over the last few years. It's worked. I'm sure it will evolve as I move forward as well.
So you plan to adopt the same approach here in Singapore too?
I think Singapore is interesting, and it's certainly going to be useful to go out there and speak to people on the Grab ride here. I was speaking to my driver. He's like saying, "What are you doing in Singapore?" And I said, "Oh, I work for this company." So I think, he was very knowledgeable about that. He says he's been playing during the circuit breaker. He's been playing probably every day for the last 8 hours with his buddies. And he says, you know what, when things got back to normal, I had to go back to work. So I can't just waste my time playing games. But he's like, the country's really investing more into this, and I wish I had more time to play. So that again is like, you use every opportunity to just authentically and not to do it in a bullshitty way, to speak to people. And whilst it's improving your own knowledge, it also gives you a very quick overview of the landscape. Mm-hmm. I mean, you go to a Singtel shop and you can see all these different content partners that they partner with, and you got the MPL there. I'm going to be working on that. That's going to be quite cool. So I think it's always putting yourself in those positions where you have a choice. You could not even get a grab. You can really just like walk to somewhere. You reduce the likelihood of you interacting with interesting people. So for sure, and I don't think that's just unique to Singapore. I think I'll probably apply that to wherever I am, whether it's here or Brazil or Turkey. If the job takes me to, or my next chapter takes me to a place, I really want to immerse myself locally. Specifically, if people are accessing the internet through these little computers in their hands, I think that's also really interesting for me.
Fantastic. Well, guys, this has been great. I think we can rest our ladders for a bit. Enough stirring for part one, lifting the lid on Asia, with Ajay Jilka of Moonton Esports. Tune in for part two, Hacking Humans. And no, we're not committing murder here. In fact, Ajay has assured us that we have at least three lives on this next level.